Hello, everyone. Do you know someone who would benefit from deeper insight into manipulation, cults, and the tools for reclaiming their life? Give them the gift of knowledge and support with a Patreon membership to the Indoctrination Podcast. It's a meaningful way to share exclusive episodes and bonus content. So here's how to do it. Head to www.patreon.com/indoctrination. Select the tier you would like to gift, and then choose the option to purchase as a gift. Enter your friend or family member's email, add a personal message, a special delivery. They'll receive a special email letting them know you've unlocked a membership just for them. Instead of another ordinary present, give the gift of empowerment, of understanding, and healing. Visit our Patreon today and share it with someone you care about.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love. Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have someone who is checking in with us from across the Atlantic. Francisco Gonzalez Espejito, otherwise known as Curo to his friends, is a PhD candidate and lecturer in psychology at Autonomous University of Madrid. He is part of the Abuse and Violence in Interpersonal Relationships research team and collaborates intensively with the Madrid City Council on public health initiatives, especially in projects focused on the evaluation of and intervention of loneliness. He also works with the Cognitive Process Modeling Group at another University of Madrid, and he addresses the methodological aspects of response process validity. He actively contributes to the Behavior Analysis and Feminism Research Group at European University Madrid, where he applies an analytic, functional approach to the construct of gender, with particular attention to gender bias in health professionals and the medicalization of women's suffering. Really, really, really important subjects. Francisco holds a master's in general health psychology and a postgraduate diploma in behavioral analysis with a feminist perspective. He is currently completing the inter-university master's in methodology of behavioral and health sciences. His research focuses on coercive control in intimate, therapeutic, and group contexts, the development and validation of psychological measures, and ethical challenges in clinical practice. He has co-authored peer-reviewed publications and is involved in several ongoing projects addressing second-generation survivors of coercive groups and harmful therapeutic processes and the structural and relational dimensions of psychological abuse. That is a lot of credentials, a lot of really, really important work. And I am excited to have you hear him. This is his first interview on a podcast that is for an English-speaking audience. His language is Spanish, Spain, Spanish. And it is incredible to hear how much he is able to speak about things and terms and scientific kind of things in another language. His English is actually impressively good. I am excited also to have you listen to his perspective on a lot of things that have not been covered yet on this podcast. Here is Francisco now. I am delighted to have Francisco González Espejito with me today. It is so nice to be able to finally meet you. I know we've been corresponding through written form, and I know you're a distance away, but I would love for you to take a moment and introduce yourself, and then we'll start covering some really interesting subjects.
Hey, thank you, Rachel. Thank you for the podcast to accept this. My name is Francisco, but my friends, people in general, used to call me Curro.
Curro?
Yes, Curro. I am a researcher teacher at the Autonomous University of Madrid in Spain, specifically focused on abuse and violence in different contexts. I try to know the different common elements across diverse contexts. Interest in this field didn't come from a single event, but from a gradual realization. Coercive influence is everywhere. It doesn't live only in isolated cults or in rare extremist groups. It appears in families, in classrooms, in digital communities, in socio-therapeutic spaces, even in relationships that from the outside look completely normal. What really caught my attention was how ordinary people, people with values, aspirations, and strong identities, could slowly lose their autonomy without noticing. The more I studied coercive control, the more I saw patterns repeating across very different contexts, a set of psychological strategies that reshape behavior, identity, and perception of reality. That connection between everyday influence and extreme coercion is what pushed me into this field. I want to understand how it works, why it works, and how people can be protected from it.
That's a really good goal, right? I mean, this is the whole reason also of doing this podcast, to protect people from these systems of control, to help people understand that's what they're in or how to prevent getting involved later on. So, Curro, if I can call you that. I know we're just meeting, but I don't know if that's sort of too much of a term of endearment for close friends. But if that's what you go by, I call you Kuro. What is really fascinating, I find, is to talk to people also from different backgrounds, from different countries, to see how things are looked at around the world in different ways. But it's interesting, the way you've already started talking about it, it feels very similar. This one point that you made already that I think is so fascinating about how these sorts of things, these groups, these relationships can look normal from the outside, sometimes even from the inside. When people have gotten to know certain people, people have been in a group for a while, they still think everything is fine because people who are manipulators are very good at being a chameleon, very good at hiding who they are and what is really happening. Yesterday, I was being interviewed for something and I was talking about the halo effect. People are assuming, right, if someone's nice or even if they're handsome or attractive, that somehow that makes them innocent in these other aspects of their life. And there's no connection at all, but we give them innocence. And it's very hard. It's very hard to train your eye to see what it needs to see. That's a really difficult thing. So I want to come back to those points, but first to have people hear from you about what caused you to be interested scholastically or even emotionally to this subject.
Okay, this is a complicated question for me, but I remember when I studied psychology in the university, I had no idea about, for example, coercive groups, pseudotherapeutic groups, this type of dynamics, which can occur commonly in these groups. But suddenly I knew a former member of a specific group. I thought it was one of these groups, one group so famous in Spain. I think that is not well known in the United States. This is so embarrassing for me because I had any knowledge about that. I started to question about his experience, about his identity, his narrative. It wasn't good. For example, right now, as a psychologist, I know that this is not a good way to approximate to different realities, specifically realities in which violence and abuse are common. So this was my first experience. Subsequently, I knew the Dr. Carmen Almendros in Madrid. She's my supervisor because I'm doing the dissertation. She started to talk to me about different elements, and I realized that how dangerous could be that these groups, these relationships. I would say that this was the first emotional impact that I did when I was a young student without knowledge, without abilities and skills. So,
wow. You know, yeah, sometimes people don't know what's going to lead them in a certain direction.
That's it.
You can't predict how it's going to go sometimes, but something gets into your head or gets into your heart and you care and you really want to understand and you want to help if you can. And how interesting that you had your own journey into this field. That's wonderful that she's able to be supervising you. She's known in this field with a lot of respect, and it is lovely that you get to work with her. It's really good also for people to know that there are resources in different places in the world. Not as many as we would like, not as many as we need, but that there are, and so that there are resources in places like Spain that has a very interesting history in terms of influence and control and the government. And there's a lot there to discuss when you talk about coercion. I am wondering about what you've seen, if there are groups that are getting bigger that we need to keep our eye on. What do you think?
I think that first, it's necessary to know what we mean by coercive, totalitarian, controlling, a normal manipulative group, because it is true that there has been a change in recent times, but the manipulation and social influence generate harmful consequences for health and quality of life due to the restriction of freedom they generate in the members as well as in the loved ones. Ecologically, they can be very diverse, ranging from religious, political, esoteric, ufological, philosophical, among others. These groups are characterized as both destructive and coercive because the techniques they employ are consistently unethical. An important aspect to consider is that what defines a destructive cult is not its beliefs, but rather the techniques of persuasion and coercion that destroy a person's personality and critical thinking, making them completely dependent on the leader, followers of the group. This is what truly corrupts the concepts of free will and freedom, because if the truth is not revealed from the outset, there is no free will. But today, I would say the fastest growing groups are not necessarily the traditional cults with physical headquarters, but rather microgroups and diffuse communities, pseudotherapeutic networks, spiritual influencers, masculinist spaces like the manosphere, extremist online ecosystems, and hybrid digital groups that operate across platforms with no clear organizational structure. So I would say that this is, in a brief way, to say that these types of groups are so dangerous because you can't make an exact quantification of the impact of these groups because they are so littered, they don't have a specific infrastructure, and it's important to recognize them because we are accustomed to speak about different groups. Like, for example, I don't know, I want to say that, Scientology, Jehovah's Witnesses, and so on, but there are a lot of groups, several groups, that they don't have a specific infrastructure and these type of things. This complicates quantification and identification of different dynamics. And I think that this is important in order to contextualize better this phenomenon.
So just to jump in here for a moment, you'll remember where you're going in this story. So you put a bookmark right there if you can. One of the things, though, that you're describing that makes this so difficult is you're describing things that are invisible, things that cannot be seen. It is not about the teachings that you see on the page or on the website and what their philosophy or theology is. It's not that the building alerts you to, oh, this is a cult, but it's in the nature of the relationship, the control mechanisms, all the things that you, especially someone new or someone from the outside, is not going to witness. And so it's about how you, I think, teach people to know what to watch out for or what to notice that is happening to them or what to notice that they're feeling. But it's just, I think people wish it were something more tangible, like, oh, this is obvious, but it's usually not.
It's true, because I think that many people, ordinary people, individuals in general population, imagine a cult or manipulative environment with completely isolated communities, messianic leaders, or dramatic events like the so-called mass immolations. This is part of the reality, but not all the reality. But these episodes are just, in my opinion, as a researcher and clinical psychology, these episodes are just the tip of the iceberg and represents very little of what actually happens in the daily lives of these groups. I think that the real problem lies in much more subtle dynamics, the control of information, the imposition of rigid rules, the progressive erosion of autonomy and personal freedom, and that a slow but profound process throughout which a person reorganizes their identity around a leader, a doctrine, or a cause. For example, in that sense, many psychosocial analyses have been conducted on terrorist groups as cults, given their very similar internal operating patterns, It doesn't matter whether the state is spiritual, political, or therapeutic. What matters are the means, the strategies of influence, and the type of bond that is built between the individual, the group, and the social context. Analyzing terrorist groups, for example, has course reverse, precisely reverse this pattern, that beyond the attacks and open violence, there is an internal dynamic that shapes elements with any manipulative group. This include progressive isolation, control of information, a weak construct through polarization, this we versus then they, and an absolute Manichaean belief system where doubt is punished and loyalty is measured in sacrifice. Also, it may sound distant, something typical of clandestine fairs or harm groups, these psychological mechanisms are not exclusive to such groups. In fact, if we jump to the present, we see how many of these processes are being replicated in completely different spaces, such as the digital environments that make up the so-called manosphere, for example. This is important because it allows us to connect two phenomena that, on the surface, seem unrelated, and yet, when we observe how radicalization, for example, works in both violent and non-violent environments, we find a common denominator, the creation of a group identity based on exclusivity, polarization, and the idea of threat. The threat might be the state, the moral decay of the world, feminism, or any other symbolic enemy. But psychologically, the effect is the same or similar.
Okay, very interesting. So when you're talking about all of this, I know that you've studied also feminist studies. We're going to talk today about the manosphere. Let's move into the manosphere. I mean, it's such an interesting term and what it's about. And it has been around since before the internet, but now it's called something now that it has this global reach and electronic reach. But I'm wondering if we can move into talking about what the manosphere is and what drives it, what concepts, what psychological concepts, and how big it is or how big it's getting and what it does to the people within it. And I wanted to say too that there was a man who had started to talk to me who got involved in a men's group. So we thought it was to help him feel more empowered as a man because his father had been very abusive towards him and had made him feel very small and weak. And so he thought this men's group would help him feel like a strong man. And some men's groups are okay, but this one moved into women hatred and how no does not mean no. He had to undo the control, the processing. We had an interesting therapy dynamic where in session, we would talk about things theoretically, but where he needed help was when he was on a date. So I let him know to let me know when he was going on a date, and I would let him know if I was going to be free during that time, and I would be on standby. And he would sometimes call me from the men's room. She's wearing this color or this skirt or said this. That means that I can sleep with her, right? And I thought, wow, I have to undo these connections that he has been given. Like one thing means something about all women. And yeah, she's wearing a short red dress. So that means that I can have sex with her, right? And I said, no, it actually only means one thing. And he said, what? And I said, she likes to wear short red dresses. Period. That's it. It doesn't mean anything about you. What? What do you mean? No, no, no. That's a sign. No, it's not. And so to disentangle these false connections about what it means for a woman and then what you as a man have permission somehow to do, it was fascinating to do that in real time with him.
That what you said, it was so interesting because in the manosphere, we can refer the manosphere has a digital spaces or digital ecosystem or digital environments in which there is first a polarization between what society call a woman or society called a man, but their main aim in these spaces is to try to gather a conglomerate of different resistance to different movements. Right now, it's true that the manosphere is focused on the progressive movements of feminism specifically, but it's true that this is not something new. Around the history, if we see the history, we can see different movements who try to express resistance to progressive movements. For example, when feminists tried to vote, there was an enormous resistance. Voting rights, for example, in the second wave of feminism, there was an enormous debate about the abortion. Right now, there is a debate too in different countries, not only in the United States, Spain too, in Madrid, specifically where I live in right now, this is a so-called debate. For example, right now, the manosphere is so clever, in my opinion, because I think that, this is my opinion, based on my experience, but I think that feminism as a movement, I think that the feminism doesn't try to understand maybe the concerns and the experiences of young kids. This is my opinion in Spain, concretely, because I think that maybe we try to design a specific discourse in order to progress in different rights, specifically rights in order to be egalitarian between men and women. But it's true that, for example, in the manosphere, if you have, for example, clients or you gather experiences from your clinical, in my opinion, from my experience, I can see a lot of kids, a lot of parents who are concerned of their children, specifically kids, or most of them are kids, because they feel lonely, they don't have reference. They feel that feminism is not for them, but not because they hate feminism, because they feel that they don't understand what feminism is. This is an important observation, in my opinion, because I think that right now, I don't know in the United States, maybe you can tell me something about that. But for example, here in Spain, we have like an enormous alert related to the manosphere spaces. Right now, in the sense that there are a lot of papers, adverts, and media, social media, who try to say, be careful with your boy, be careful with yourself. And I think that this is important because the prevention in that sense is crucial, in my opinion, but I think that it could be dangerous too because we forget, as psychology, I have to say that, we forget that the language, not our language, not only describe the reality, also language produce realities. This is so common in cult environments, abusive environments, and for example, when social media don't take the enough responsibility to talk about this, maybe we can create in ordinary people, citizens, a specific alarm, which maybe it's not true at all. This is important because, for example, here in Spanish, there are different psychologists, psychiatrists, and sociologists that they think that, for example, before we ask what's wrong with these boys, for example, we have to ask what needs are not being met elsewhere. Boys who feel invisible, boys who feel rejected, boys who feel ashamed of their own insecurities, often find in the manosphere the first space where someone says, your pain makes sense, that's the hood, and that emotional recognition is incredibly powerful, especially in a culture that still tells boys to hide vulnerability.
Right, absolutely. So I just want to say, before you continue, yes, your point about how language produces certain environments, certain emotions, certain realities in people's minds. We have it with racism. We have it with anti-Semitism. We have it all over. The language that's used really shifts people's vision of something in a very different way than it really is. And same thing with feminism, that somehow it's a threat and somehow it's hatred. But it really is just simply equality, period, the end, full stop. But yes, I think when people think, oh no, what is this going to mean for me? Then they think that it's like, there's some people I think in the world where they approach things like a pie chart, where it's only divided. If someone takes more from you, then you have less. But I think rights are expansive. I don't think it's a pie chart. I think that if everyone has equal, then everyone has equal. One hasn't taken away from someone else. But it's a different vision, I think, of how you look at things. If someone getting something is taking it away from you, as though there's just a limited resource in terms of things like rights, and there's unlimited resource. I think people who feel more worried, fearful about their place and their power are going to use this kind of language that it's a threat. It's very interesting. I think it has so much to do with the person's emotions or how they, through social media, have been taught to look at this.
Yes, that's it. I agree with you, because I think that when we see these kids or we try to analyze these types of spaces, like the manosphere, I think that maybe we forget one essential thing, which is something that you said before, is that when you are in a specific group with these characteristics, you are captive by the emotion, by the affect, not by the rationality and by the...
Right, by facts.
Yes, that's it. This is important because a lot of parents who are so concerned didn't notice of that or didn't realize of that at the beginning. It's common because they don't have the necessary skills to face with this type of circumstance, of forcing circumstance. I think this is important also with the topic of the language, because this is the beginning of the radicalization, or one of the first signs of radicalization or identity fusion, in my opinion. In that sense, the process begins to mirror what we see in coercive control. At first, the content is relatable, videos about self-improvement, humor, dating advice, confidence. Then gradually, rules start appearing. Women behave like this, men must behave like that. Masculinity is discipline, empathy is weakness, vulnerability is manipulation, and the world is divided into winners and losers. With this type of we versus they, you know, these rules don't just describe the world, they create it. A young person who internalizes then begins to interpret all the experience through that lens. If someone rejects them, it's hypergamy, a concept which is so common in this space, that something, in order to insult something who rejects the group or the ideas of the group. If they feel sad, it's because society is anti-men. If a girl sets a boundary, it's because she's testing dominance. These are not neutral ideas. They are behavioral instructions that shape emotional life in that sense.
Wow, that's so interesting. That's so interesting. And I'm wondering also culturally, when we talk about places, yes, in the United States, but also there is machismo in different countries that adds to this, I think, and also with men here in the United States, yes, machismo is a big deal, but also there is this idea of limited resources, like a woman's going to take my job or is going to start making more, maybe even closer to what the men make, and then there won't be as much for me to be able to make, like they're encroaching on what I'm going to be able to receive. And that is interesting. I think now with our government, with how many billions are spent on things, for people to say, if I make $5,000 more than this person isn't going to get, there are enough resources to go around. Everyone should be well taken care of, well fed, if it gets distributed, I think, as it should be. But how do the cultural issues that you see around you affect this issue as well?
This is so, so, so accurate for your part, because in this case, the political context, the sociocultural context has an enormous impact. When you do a brief search, for example, in Google, about manosphere, you can see that the Manosphere has a huge association with far-right extremism. And this is associated too with Manosphere involvement, conspiracy networks, or pseudotherapeutic groups. And in that sense, I want to share with you an experience in Spanish. This is from a report, a Spanish report, describes cases in which young people aspire into far-right groups, not because of ideology, and I think is an aspect so interesting, but because the groups offer three things: belonging, recognition, and narrative clarity. This is so important for me, for it personally, because I think that this is maybe the job of, or the task, sorry, the task that feminism person who, like you and me, for example, try to have a better world with progress ideas, with egalitarian values. I think that maybe we have this pendant task in order to how to attract this voice, in order that this voice have the main idea that if they join with us or if they try to articulate spaces with us, maybe they feel better. And I think that these three things, belonging, recognition, and narrative clarity, is important because one young man, for example, explained that his entry point was memes. He began to follow influencers who framed his frustration as evidence of cultural decay. And then came community chats. Finally, came ideas about defending the nation and fighting the enemy. At no point did he feel he was doing something extreme. He felt it gaining meaning. And this is important, this real experience, for example, from a boy in a Spanish report, no? And it's important because it's true that the far-right ideas and values associated with right political groups, that's it true, but it's not about ideology. There are a lot of experiences, for example, as clinical psychologists, I gather different experiences, and I have parents who were concerned about their kids in this type of far-right extremist groups. The most curious thing for me or aspect is that the ideology, it wasn't not so important. Maybe the ideology is much like the content, but inside, most of these kids try to join to this group for another things. As I said before, like loneliness, and for example, memes, it's a good way of attracting people of that, like kids. So it's curious that the ideology is not so commented in the experience of these kids. But it's true that these groups use their ideology in another way in order to create indoctrination, influence, and so on.
Very interesting. Yeah, the whole idea of memes and grabbing people's attention very quickly as they're scrolling, because they say that now, if you can't make an impression within 3 seconds, which is very stressful, if you're doing any kind of advertising for anything that matters, then you've lost your audience now. And so it has to be immediate, really immediate. And memes are this perfect delivery system of messaging.
And for me, there is one aspect that is important. And I think that in the United States is a similar case that in Spain in this example, because right now we have, I don't know how to say this term or this word, but we can say that we have like a different crisis of, for example, right now in the research field, we are now in a scenario in which the construct gender identity is more fluid than which maybe people thought in past centuries, for example, no? Like sexuality is more fluid than something, it is not only something dichotomous, binary, no? In that sense, I think that this generates a lot of ambivalent emotions in ordinary people, in people, and it's understandable. In fact, it's understandable because this type of findings, it's so counterintuitive for people. It's something like, oh, I was wrong all my life about, for example, gender identity or sexuality. I don't know. It's something that we have to investigate more right now. But I think that, for example, spaces like the Manosphere, far-right extremist groups, use the uncertainty. This because right now there is a large part of the feminists or feminist movements who say that uncertainty, maybe it could be something positive because it's realistic that we have uncertainty in different moments of our life. So it's important to have uncertainty now and try to explore. Maybe in a subsequently, we have different response, but we don't know. This is like a part of the feminist movement who try to explain that, for example, in the gender identity. But right now, far rights or certain political groups use the uncertainty as an attack in order to attack the uncertainty. And they offer, as conflict groups, they offer more sense of security and send you the main message of we have certainty. This type of uncertainty is not safe. This type of uncertainty, it could be dangerous. It's a form of alienating your sons. And this is dangerous because we have to be realistic. And right now we are in a moment when maybe we have to educate people or to teach people that we have to explore. We have to search new answers because the world is changing. People are changing. Gender identity is something more fluid. So I think that political groups use these types of uncertainties in progressive movements in order to attack them and to attract people who feel rejected for this type of ideas or something similar. And this is important because I think that maybe feminist movement and person who try to support them, maybe this person have to think and reflect about what I have to do in order to learn, especially young people, that uncertainty is not something bad. And this is important because, for example, in former members, we see that uncertainty is something horrible because they are accustomed. They live with rules and the rules are so rigid and they offer you uncertainty. But this is important. I try to explain that because I think this shows similarities with coercive groups.
Okay, right. So you bring up a really interesting point. We can talk about certainty and how some people need it more than others. I've always found that fascinating, why certain people need it more than others, or what is it in their background that's trained them to have this binary look at everything, that you're either good or you're bad. Like what happens sometimes within cultic systems or even within abusive households, you can be the victim and the perpetrator all at once. That like makes people's heads explode. Like, what? That can't be possible. But it is when you know that something bad is going to happen to you if you admit to doing something. So you might blame your brother or your sister for having done it just to give yourself the day off from being abused. So you can be the victim and the perpetrator. There's too much focus, I think, on the person being caught in the middle rather than on the person who has created that system, who's made them feel trapped in both roles. And then they feel guilty about that later on, but the person in charge doesn't feel guilty about doing this to them. I wish there was a different focus when people are trying to figure that out. But certainty is something that some people want, especially people, I think, from religious backgrounds. They're so used to having an answer that I think you just check in with yourself and it feels so good, feels so relieving to have an answer that often people don't go to the next step, which is wondering if the answer is true. It doesn't matter. But I have an answer and that feels good. Now I can move on. You know, I think about how much we still need to learn from other civilizations. And here in the United States, there's a lot to be really ashamed about with our treatment of Native Americans. But it is also true that Native Americans have the two-spirit, the gender that's two-spirit, both genders at once. They recognize sometimes in certain tribes up to five genders. And that all worked because there was a term for it. They were part of the community. And, oh, that's what I'm seeing. That's what I'm sensing from that person. Here's what they are, because people like labels. But it wasn't like that you're right or you're wrong. You are just a combination and that's how you were created. So let's just figure out how we classify that so we understand it, but you are an equal citizen. Other civilizations have done it, no problem. I'm sure there was some tension here and there in some tribes, but still, overall, no problem. I don't know why it's so hard for us to do this. It seems so simple.
I think that this is a part, even there is a part of the psychology research. I think that sociologists try to investigate this part too. And there are scientific works who try to study the narratives, the life stories of people with qualitative methodology. And the main focus is to focus on the thematic contents of the narratives of people in order to know better about how people describe, for example, gender identity, history identity, and so on. And this is so complicated. For me, so complicated because I realized that, for example, I am a colleague in the university. Her name is Maria. She's studying narratives. I didn't realize of that, but it was so curious because, for example, she's trying to study gender identity a lot in the lifetime of a person. It was so curious because these people, when you have a specific question about his or her gender or gender identity, that person who describes him or herself as this, suddenly he or she started to have doubts and something like, wow, I never question about that because I accept that it's likely that I will be this. But right now, in that meeting with you, with these questions, I realize that I understand the word in a specific and even in a reductionist way. For me, this is important because in this world, when we try to talk about diversity and this type of concepts, we always try to speak about trans people, non-binary people, but what about the heterogeneity in normative or normal people? This is another gap in the research. Right now, there are a lot of scientists in the United States, in Spain, in Europe, and so on, who are working in that. And this is so interesting. In my opinion, I think that, for example, people who are called like normative or normal people, they present more risk factors to enter in this type of environments like manosphere because they don't question, they don't have enough training. Because, for example, in this experience who are close to me, like the experience of my college, she said to me, Curro, they didn't realize of that. They don't have question of that because anybody, because the world, because the environment, the sociocultural context, consider that this is not important for them. But suddenly, when you started to investigate, and I repeat, this is a gap, this is right now in process, but when people, researchers are investigating this topic, they can find different findings related to the normative or normal people because they don't have the space to think about certain aspects. I think this is so important, crucial, and significant. At the same time, is so associated with main risk factor to enter in a cult environment or the manosphere or digital space environment because they don't have enough training. It's true that, for example, trans people, non-binary people, it's true that they count with risk factors for the sociocultural context. That's it's true. But we forget that even normal people don't have the enough training to think about certain topics. And this is so important for me, and for me, so associated with these digital environments.
Yeah. And I think people can come across as an expert all too easily if they have the right way of speaking, if they have graphs and things behind them, if they have good lighting, I mean, all the things that are superficial. There was actually a comedy group that did this. It was like the latest news, a big story, and they said nothing, but it was, let's go to this graph that has lines on it and numbers. And now let's go to someone on the street who's wearing a suit. And now let's go, right, and all these things. And let's go to this woman, and she's holding a puppy. So we're going to listen to her. And it was like all these things that get into your head. Yeah, we get influenced a lot. And I'm wondering, moving on into this idea of the pseudo-therapeutic world, the pseudoscience world, because that whole try this and this will cure this and take this because this is better than that. And I was talking to one of my kids last night about this. They hate watching videos that start with doctors hate us for having this product, or dentists don't like that we're announcing this. What? They interviewed every dentist. They know every doctor, right? They're, of course, already it's false. Or big pharma, big pharmacy companies are going to hate us for offering you this special magical thing because it works better than all these other pharmaceuticals. People just say things and it catches your attention and it makes it sound legitimate and special and one of a kind. And you'd be a fool for not getting it. But it's all advertising.
Yes, it's so interesting, specifically about the experience of your kids, because when we talk, for example, about pseudotherapeutic groups today, it's essential to place them in the socio-political and cultural moment we are living. For example, we are in a world marked by uncertainty, anxiety, loneliness, and a deep erosion of trust in institutions, including healthcare. I don't know how this is in the United States, but in Spain, we are right now in a controversial moment in that sense. And many people reach out for help in moments of genuine vulnerability, because as human social beings, we are vulnerability in different aspects, all of us. But they reach that help, they don't feel seen, they encounter rush appointments, diagnostic delays, medical gaslighting, a stigma around mental health, gender bias, and a system often perceived as cold, bureaucratic, or even violent. All of this creates a perfect breeding ground for alternative spaces that promise the opposite: time, warmth, validation, meaning, and a narrative that makes suffering feel coherent. It's not only that coercive groups offer you a narrative of you will be great. Yes, that's its part of the coercive groups, but something that is so attractive of coercive groups is that they offer you a specific narrative in order to make you suffering in a more coherent way, with the intention that you try to explain better your suffering. It really is a way of manipulation. But a person who are in this type of groups, they didn't notice of that because it's a progressive manipulation, but also it's because you don't want to be great. This is important because there are a lot of persons who don't want to be good because they feel that they won't be good in the future. They are persons in that mood. But also, on the other hand, they are persons who enter in these environments when they feel good. And this is important too, because I think that the most ancient literature focused on coercive groups focus mostly in the vulnerability, in the law, in people who lost something and this type of things. But right now, for example, with the manosphere, it's not so clear. I am, to be honest, and knowing my limitations, I don't have in this topic a specific answer because the experiences are so diverse. There are kids who enter with a lot of positive emotions and other kids who enter with loneliness, anxiety, and a lot of uncertainty. And this is important to know and to take into account, because it is true that psychiatrists, important psychiatrists in the field and psychologists like Stephen Hassan and Robert Lifton, when they try to categorize these environments, the coercive groups, the cults, they explain that one of the main strategies to recruit a person is generating positive emotions. But it's generating. But in this case, based on my experience, I don't have any specific evidence that this type of environments generate that positive emotion, because there are people who feel good when they enter before. So this is important. And this is in that maybe this is the change and the difference with coercive and classic groups in that sense, because in you enter in internet and search manosphere and different blogs, websites, and so on, you can see that, in fact, there are no many positive emotions. In fact, there are hatred and negative emotions, and this is not so common in another groups. When you enter, like, for example, if you enter or you know a person or family members or a close friend who are in a specific group like Jehovah Witnesses or Scientology, they feel more good. But when you talk with someone who is in the manosphere and who is integrated in that type of environments, they speak with more negative emotion with positive, because I think that the manosphere has this crucial aspect, which is so focused on the sociocultural context about certain politicians, certain groups, left politician groups specifically. And I think this is a main difference in that sense. But it's important because I think that we have to investigate more about that, because it's likely that the form of captation and recruitation, it's reproduced other forms of manipulation that coercive or classic groups don't reproduce in the same way. I don't know how I explained that. It was difficult for me, but there are certain differences which are important to take into account.
Right. I think what's interesting too is that sometimes people will want to feel good, or they feel good about how they feel bad. Like they connect over their fellow diagnoses. And I think that there is this sense of, or the need for connection and community more than feeling better. It's reminding me of, there was a book years ago, I won't mention because people got upset when I mentioned it before, but it was this idea that if you have gaps in your memory from your childhood, that means absolutely that you were abused or sexually abused. So a lot of people were coming forward because a lot of us can't remember every moment of our childhood. It's just not possible. So they were saying that they were part of this community of people who had all been abused. That must be the answer because it said it in this book. What was interesting was once people went to therapy or even brought their parents up on charges, and the parents were thinking, "What? No, this didn't happen." And lots of details made it very hard for parents. A lot of people didn't want to admit that it hadn't happened to them because they would lose their community. They would lose the community of survivors of this, which you understand psychologically. It makes sense that once people have found something where they can feel like they can be emotional, they feel understood, they don't want to leave it, even if it's false. It's very interesting. It's very interesting what we gravitate towards and why, what we need. But I think with pseudoscience, it is really, really, really frustrating. It's really hard when people also have all these techniques. Therapists are using different techniques, or coaches using techniques, healers. Because built into that, I think, is that, oh, if the technique is perfect, like according to Lifton, there's the sacred science, right? It's perfect. If it doesn't work, that's on you. You didn't do it right, or you didn't do it enough.
Your responsibility, yes.
Right. The responsibility is on you.
Yes. For me, this is important in psychotherapies because it's one of the main mechanisms which is essential, no? The linguistic recording. These groups speak the language of psychology, but without psychological rigor. Terms like trauma, boundaries, ego, energy, or inner child become tools not for understanding, but for reorganizing a person's interpretation of their own emotions. Doubt becomes framed as ego resistance, for example, for discomfort becomes a healing crisis. Terms are experienced from different users. Concern from family becomes fear of your transformation. Critical thinking becomes low vibration. And this language is not just symbolic. It functions behaviorally. It blocks alternative interpretations and creates a closed feedback loop where everything that happens reinforces the worldview of the group. We see an almost identical process in online, for example, in online self-harm communities. I don't know if you know these environments, but this is something which is beginning to research right now. this community say shows how code vocabulary, venting, spicy barcode creates identity, belonging, and ultimately self-regulation or harmful norms. And this type of communities try to stimulate self-harm behaviors. And in pseudotherapies, for example, the content shifts towards spirituality of trauma or trauma, but the effect is the same, a parallel emotional universe that feels more real than the outside world. For example, another key factor is the illusion of autonomy. Many people inside these groups essentially feel that their involvement is self-directed. They say, I chose this. And from a subjective standpoint, they are right, but behaviorally, their choices begin to be governed by the rule system of the group. The person becomes less sensitive to real-world consequences and more dependent on the narratives offered by the community. And this is what researchers like Stephen Hayes and others describe as insensitivity to contingencies, a shift where behavior is directed by rules rather than lived experiences. In that sense, pseudotherapeutic, for example, pseudotherapeutic communities excel at creating precisely that environment. They offer emotionally intense rituals, cathartic sessions, breakthrough moments, and cycles of breakdown, healing, breakdown, empowerment. These emotional highs allows gradually create dependency, and you feel bad. The group explains it. The explanation fits. You want, you stay. It mirrors what we've seen in manosphere spaces where emotional vulnerability is met with rules like never show weakness, women manipulate, discipline is your only truth, or your pain is part of becoming a high-value man. One is framed as spirituality, the other as masculinity. But psychologically, both recruit through meaning-making systems that offer identity in exchange for obedience. And if you let me, another powerful ingredient is, in my opinion, isolation disguised as authenticity. Over time, pseudotherapies encourage distance from the outside world. Family members who express concern become toxic, for example, toxic. Friends who question things are not aligned with your vibration. And traditional clinicians become part of the problem. This mirrors coercive control, cult dynamics, manosphere bubbles, and even these communities like self-harm communities and even pro-ANA group norms. I don't know if you know these groups, pro-ANA, but they are groups in which there is no a specific leader, but all users reinforce each other in order to have a specific disease related with nutrition or alimentation. This is part of the investigation which is started to investigate this as a coercive group tool. So it's interesting, and little by little, the world shrinks to the size of this type of group.
It's incredible. Yeah, I'm going to talk more about that maybe in the outro at some point, or maybe for you to come back on if you want to talk more about these self-harm communities that are using gaming platforms, and it's a whole talk. So maybe we'll have a part two of this, because I want to be able to get to that. Maybe we'll put that on our calendars and continue.
Maybe we can meet in person. I will be in New York from February to April.
Wow, February to April. Okay, that's a long stretch. Okay, I might be able to get to the East Coast. We'll see. If not, then we can talk whenever. But I think it's an important subject, and I'll talk a little bit about it. But if you want to be able to talk more, let's do that. It is a really big problem with these self-harm communities. I'm glad that we got through as much material as we did today, and there's always more to talk about. But it was really great being able to talk to you and hearing from your perspective on a lot of different subjects. And so if people want to be in touch, or they want to see what you're learning, or do you have an email or a website or something through school where if people have questions for you, if that's okay with you, they can reach you?
I have my institutional email in which person from different backgrounds can ask me what they desire in whatever coercive groups, personal experiences. We have website of the research group of the university. But I think that right now it's in process because we had an online attack, a hacker, I think. It was strange. But yes, I can text you the email and the website.
Great. So then we'll put it in the show notes for the episode. So it will be Perfect. Listed there. Okay, great. It was really a treat to speak with you. Thank you so much. And I'm so glad that you are coming into this field with all of your interest and your intellectual approach, but also clearly with your good heart. And hopefully we'll talk again.
Yes. Thank you, Rachel, to you and Robert and all the people who are behind Industry Nation. Thank you so much. I'm so delighted.
Oh, good. Very excited to talk to you. Talk to you soon. One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Francisco. Not only was he speaking in a language that is not his language, but he was using incredible terminology. And he also had a cold, so he was really working hard. And I really appreciate all of that. He really is doing some fascinating studies and has so much to share, and I hope to be able to talk to him again. One of the things that we just started talking about at the end was this idea of self-harm communities, which sounds really as disturbing as it is. There are gaming platforms that have recently been in the news as being places where people are reaching out, trying to gain control over those that they can talk into harming themselves. It is most often men who are searching out young women and girls to self-harm and then show that they were willing to self-harm by sending photos, videos, to show their allegiance to these men and to show that they're willing to do this, that they're brave enough and strong enough to do this. Really is quite an incredible thing and very disturbing thing that is happening under people's noses, but I really wanted to be able to highlight it so that you know what is happening. I'm not going to get into the specifics of the self-harm because that's much too disturbing, but these are stories that you can research on your own. I just wanted you to know, and I bring this up as a therapist, but also as a parent. Online gaming platforms such as Roblox and Discord, Minecraft, Fortnite, Call of Duty have been identified, so I'm not doing slander. This is true and in the news. They've been identified by law enforcement and child safety experts as common venues where predators target and groom children. These platforms are exploited because they have features that offer anonymity and direct access to minors through chat functions and false sense of security for parents. And so when parents think that their kids are just going to play games, they are not looking over what the games are. And also, they're not necessarily looking to see what the kids are doing in between playing. So there were recently a number of heads of Roblox who came forward saying, it's not that bad, basically, was their message over and over again. Don't worry about it, or we don't have that problem, or we only used to have that problem, we don't have it anymore. Whatever the party line was that they felt they had to get across, the message that really comes across is, we're not going to be doing what we can to protect you. And we're not going to be doing what we need to do to protect your children. When an organization, when a big business says, it's not that bad, or like one of the CEOs was saying, yeah, we had a problem, but that was 5 years ago. Well, no, it was actually this week. But to say it was 5 years ago, still, okay, not, it's horrible, and this is what we're doing to help people, and this is what we're doing to warn people. Oh, it was 5 years ago is a meaningless statement. So with Roblox, they have a large user base of children under 13, and its in-game chat and private messaging features are frequently used for initial contact. Predators often pose as peers, people of the same age, and use in-game gifts like Robux to build trust and then attempt to move conversations to less moderated platforms. The platform is currently facing multiple lawsuits regarding child safety issues. And then we have Discord. This messaging and voice chat platform is often used alongside gaming and is a primary destination for moving conversations away from more public platforms. Its private messaging, voice channels, and file sharing capabilities make it easier to isolate and exploit their victims. And now we move on to Minecraft, Fortnite, and Call of Duty. And these are just the ones that I'm mentioning today and that I know about today, but there certainly could be others. And if so, let us know. So Minecraft, Fortnite, and Call of Duty, these and other multiplayer games with communication features, text to voice chat mainly, are also used by predators. They leverage the need for teamwork and communication within the game in order to make these connections, in order to have this kind of communication. So, something already that I mentioned is that these predators will pose as peers. They'll create profiles with age-appropriate usernames and avatars to blend in and appear as children, saying things like, "Oh, I know, I hate my English teacher too," but meanwhile, this person is 50 years old. Building trust, they use shared interests in gaming, compliments, or virtual gifts to gain a child's confidence over time. And then they also move things to private communication. Once trust is established, the predator encourages the child to move to platforms with fewer oversight, with fewer or no parental controls and less moderation, such as Snapchat, Kick, or private Discord servers. Then there's the sextortion and blackmail. Predators may coerce children into sending explicit photos or videos of themselves, which are then used for blackmail and extortion. And the use of AI to generate explicit images is a new and growing threat. So, how do you stay safe? Child safety advocates and law enforcement recommend several measures for parents and for guardians. Use parental controls wherever you can. Utilize and actively manage the built-in parental controls offered by platforms like Roblox and others. Monitor activity. Be aware of who your child is interacting with online and look for secretive behavior such as closing laptops right away or hiding phones when you enter the room. Talk to your children. Maintain open communication about the online dangers and establish rules for internet use. Advise them never to share personal information or photos with online friends, and friends is in air quotes. Also, please report your concerns. Immediately report any suspicious activity or suspected exploitation to local law enforcement or to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. It's also important that I add the following. There are some kids who I've talked to who were caught up in these self-harm communities. And one of the things that kept coming up with these kids was that they felt alienated from their peers, or they felt like they had issues that their peers couldn't relate to. They felt depressed, or they felt anxious, or they had trouble managing their emotions or managing their behavior, so they were ostracized from their peers. And so if you have a child or know of a child who doesn't have a friend group and doesn't have something that they do that makes them feel good about themselves and makes them feel connected to the world around them, they're going to be more at risk for being able to be sucked into these communities because it fulfills those needs. So notice who your child is and what they need and how to serve their needs in society at large, how to serve those needs within the family system, within a friend group, or helping them develop a friend group that helps them feel that they are special and wanted and needed, and then a predator and them trying to attach to your child is not at all going to be successful because they're not going to be looking for or needing what a predator is going to be promising to give them. So stay safe out there. Do your due diligence, do your research, find out But with your child, don't be accusatory. Just understand and understand why this speaks to them and understand why they were vulnerable to it and what that means about what they need outside of these gaming platforms. Take good care. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.